Here on Radio 4 FM, it's Mom and Me and Mom. Adjoa Ando continues her reading of Maya Angelou's memories of her relationship with her extraordinary mother, the feisty Vivian Baxter.
By the time I was 22, I was living in San Francisco. I had a 5-year-old son, 2 jobs and rented rooms, with cooking privileges down the hall. My mother picked Guy up twice a week and took him to her house where she fed him peaches and cream and hot dogs, but I only went to Fulton Street once a month and at an agreed time. She understood and encouraged my self-reliance, and I looked forward eagerly to our standing appointments. One lunch date stands out in my mind. I call it Vivian's Red Rice Day. When I arrived, my mother was dressed beautifully. Her makeup was perfect, and she wore good jewelry. Lunch was already on the kitchen table. Vivian Baxter was very serious about her delicious meals. That day she offered me a crispy dry roasted capon and a simple lettuce salad. A wide-mouthed bowl covered with a platter sat next to her plate. She fervently blessed the food, then put her left hand on the platter and turned the dishes over, gently loosening the bowl to reveal a tall mound of glistening red rice, my favorite food in the entire world. Each grain of that red rice is emblazoned on the surface of my tongue forever. My mother had plans for the rest of her afternoon, so she gathered her wraps and we left the house together. As we were due to part, she said, "Baby, I've been thinking, and now I'm sure. You are the greatest woman I've ever met." I looked down at the pretty little woman with her diamond earrings and silver fox scarf. She was admired by most people in San Francisco's black community, and even some whites liked and respected her. She continued, "You are very kind and very intelligent, and those elements are not always found together. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, and my mother. Yes, you belong in that category. Here, give me a kiss." Then she turned and jaywalked across the street to her beige and brown Pontiac. I waited for the number 22 streetcar. My policy of independence wouldn't allow me to accept money or even a ride from my mother, but I welcomed her and her wisdom. Now I thought of what she'd said. I thought, suppose she's right? Suppose I am really going to become somebody someday? Imagine. Nina was a striptease dancer I'd met at dance class. She told me she made $300 a week stripping in a nightclub. She suggested I try it. I knew I wouldn't want to be known as a striptease dancer, but the prospect of $300 per week was tantalizing. I called my mother. She came to my apartment and said, "Let me make you a costume and you choreograph a dance. If you take a theme like Scheherazade, you can use the music of Duke Ellington, Night in Morocco. Understand, if you're not going to take off your costume, what you wear will have to be skimpy. And if you're not going to disrobe, you have to really be dancing." We went to a theatrical costume shop and bought gauzy brassieres and G-strings and feathers, sequins and beads, which we crowded onto them. I hired a Congo drummer who played for the dance classes at the community center. At the audition, barefoot and nearly naked, I shouted, "Caravan!" and hit the floor. I began to dance sensually, sultrily. I picked up the tempo and danced faster. Again, I shouted, "Caravan!" shimmying and quivering. Finally, I slowed down again before saying, "Caravan," in a large stage whisper, and walking off. The owner gave me the job. My mother wasn't surprised. You are going far in this world, baby, because you dare to risk everything. A few popular San Francisco columnists wrote about my performances at the Bon Nuit Dance Club. San Franciscans started to crowd in. A group of men in expensive casual clothes came regularly, with a woman who smoked cigarettes in a holder and spoke as I thought Tallulah Bankhead would. They were witty and easy to talk to. They invited me to visit the Purple Onion, which they owned. One night I introduced them to calypso music. 4 months after I started dancing the Hoochie Coochie at the Bon Nuit Dance Club, I opened as the star singing calypso songs at the Purple Onion for $750 a week. The publicity announced that I was a Watusi, born in Cuba. My mother laughed until tears came down her cheeks. She said she had never met a Watusi and had never been to Cuba, but she could swear that I was her daughter. A producer of Porgy and Bess telephoned me and offered me the role of Ruby, the girlfriend of Sport and Life. The musical was preparing to tour Europe. Mother said, "You can't turn down that chance. Aunt Lottie and I will take care of Guy." A few weeks later, I boarded the plane with my luggage and enough guilt to last me a year. Porgy and Bess boasted a cast with the top African-American operatic voices. I enjoyed myself, but I knew that if I missed Guy as much as I did, he must be missing me more. I was old enough to know that I'd be seeing him soon, but the years I'd spent in Arkansas without my mother made me know how lost a child feels when a parent is missing. When I finally got back to Fulton Street, the reunion was greater than the drama in Russian novels. I wrapped my arms around him, and he sobbed on my chest. "I swear to you, I'll never leave you again. If I go, when I go, wherever I go, you'll go with me, or I won't go." By the time Guy was 16, we were living in Los Angeles. Singing in the nightclub Cosmos Alley, I'd met the great poet Langston Hughes and John Killen, the novelist. I told them I was a poet and wanted to write.
"Why don't you come to New York?"
John Killen asked. I called my mother. "I'd love to see you before I leave." She said, "Oh, baby, I want to see you too, because I'm going to see."
"To see what?"
"I'm going to become a seaman." My mother had a real estate license, she'd been a nurse, and she owned a gambling house and a hotel.
"Why do you want to go to sea?"
"Because they told me they wouldn't let any woman in their union. They suggested that the union certainly wouldn't accept a Negro woman. I told them, 'You want to bet? I will put my foot in their door up to my hip until every woman can get in that union and get aboard a ship and go to sea.'" I didn't question that she would do exactly what she said. We met a few days later in Fresno at a newly integrated hotel. We pulled into the parking lot at almost the same time. We went inside the lobby. Even in this newly integrated hotel, people were literally amazed to see two black women walking in. My mother asked, "Where's the bell cap?" Someone stepped up to her. She said, "My daughter's bag and my bag's outside beside the black Dodge. Bring them in, please." I followed as she walked to the desk and said to the clerk, "I am Mrs. Jackson, and this is my daughter, and we have reserved rooms." The clerk stared at us as if we were wild things from the forest. He looked at his book and found that we did indeed have reservations. My mother took the keys he offered and followed the bellman with the bags to the elevator. Upstairs, we stopped in front of a door, and she tipped him. Inside the room, she opened her bag, and lying on top of her clothes was a .38 revolver. She said, "If they weren't ready for integration, I was ready to show it to them." I went to Stockholm because a screenplay of mine was being shot there. The play was about an African-American nightclub singer who was the toast of Europe. I based her on the personality of Eartha Kitt. The actress who played the role wasn't a singer, so I wrote music for her that she could simply speak on pitch. She had been to my apartment in New York to thank me. The star we'd wanted for the male lead wasn't available, so we cast another actor. I was sitting in my hotel lobby when a young African-American man saw me and ran over. He got down on his knees. "Maya Angelou, you are really so great. You really are our Shakespeare, and I thank you for this chance." I said, "Don't kneel, please. Sometimes people put people on pedestals so they can see them more clearly and knock them off more easily. Please, get up." A Swedish director had been chosen. The shooting began. The star was a true glamour queen. The luxuriant wig she wore floated around her face. As the story progressed from time to time, she would remove the wig. Beneath, her hair was in braided cornrows. None of the Swedish beauticians knew how to plait cornrows, and I was obliged to go to the set on early mornings to braid the star's hair. I appreciated the opportunity, since I could see how films were made. I developed a new ambition. I wanted to direct a movie. In 1972, I didn't know any place in the United States where a 40-year-old black woman could learn filming, and I was happy that I'd happened upon my chance. At the beginning of the fourth week, the star told the director that when I was on the set, she got nervous. Sorry, but she didn't want me there. The director, who'd never even shaken a black person's hand, felt caught between the Mississippi and the North Sea. He asked me to come to the set only to braid her hair and then leave. The next week, the actor who'd thrown himself on his knees claimed the company had supplied real jewelry for the star, but had only given him zircons. He said he didn't come to Sweden to be treated like a second-class citizen, and he was returning to New York. I went to his hotel. "What are you doing? You realize we've shot 4 weeks. This is the first time that any black woman has ever had a screenplay done by a major company. We can't afford to send for another actor now. You said you wanted to do it." He looked at me. "Who in the hell do you think you are? Shakespeare?" I got on my knees. "Please, I beg you to reconsider." He told me what I could do to myself. I stood up and became Vivian Baxter. "Thank you for that, you silly ass. Now I'll stay up all night and rewrite the rest of your role out of the script. I'll have you run over by a Swedish bus. I promise you I'll make the audience applaud when you die." He sobered quickly.
"Listen, I didn't mean it. I just wanted to see how serious you were about wanting me."
I went back to my hotel and called my mother. I didn't use lady or mother. I said, "Mom, I need mothering."
Adjoa Ando, reading Mom and Me and Mom by Maya Angelou. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. And tomorrow, Maya is in Sweden for the filming of her screenplay and in need of some motherly support. After the news, Helena Morrissey champions women on boards, and does a laddish culture prevail on university campuses? Women's Hour with Jenny in a couple of minutes.
Starting next Monday, BBC Radio 4 brings you daily tales of rural life.
"We need a good hodra to meet our friends, talk about life, hide weapons."
"Just keep an eye on your guest, son."
With concerns both educational...
"You'll have every outlaw in the land hiding out here. And what about the education?"
"Education is a waste of time."
"And agricultural."
"Who wants a sick animal in their bedroom?"
"It's the only separate place we have."
An everyday story of Afghan folk on BBC Radio 4. Next Monday morning at 11:15 and again in the evening at 7:45.